Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for a real look at Southeast Asia's digital economy.
Yeah, high velocity tour, you could say.
Exactly. We're really zeroing in on the big strategic shifts, specifically in food delivery and transport. We're drawing a lot from that new economy SEA report, the Google, Temasek, and Bain one.
And this is perfect timing, I think, especially if you're a strategist listening in, because this year's report, it's not just an update, it's kind of a landmark.
How so?
Well, they've officially expanded the scope. It's not just the SEA 6 anymore. Now it covers the full CUN 10.
Right, bringing in Brunei, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar.
Yeah, exactly. So now we're talking about a market of, what, 614 million people? It gives us a much truer picture.
That definitely scales things up.
Yeah.
So our mission today, for you listening, is really to boil down the key strategic takeaways. You know, how do business leaders navigate this? It feels like a two-pronged thing. Getting disciplined about making money now.
Uh-huh. Monetization discipline.
But also getting ready for some, frankly, radical disruption down the line.
And that discipline is key because the numbers are just staggering. The whole digital economy in SEA, it's heading towards like $300 billion in GMV for 2025.
Wow. Gross merchandise value.
Yeah, GMV. And what's really telling is the growth. It sustained double digits, around 15% year on year for GMV. But crucially, revenue growth is often right there with it, sometimes even outpacing it.
Okay, and that's the signal, isn't it? When revenue growth matches or beats volume growth.
It means the take rate is improving?
Yeah, they're getting better at actually turning that volume into, you know, actual money, cash.
Precisely. They're keeping more of each transaction.
Okay, let's dive into food delivery first then, because the story there seems to be this major pivot, right, towards sustainable profits.
Absolutely. Food delivery is really growing up. It's moving out of that phase of just burning cash for growth at any cost. For 2025, they're looking at maybe $23 billion in GMV across the ASEAN 10.
$23
billion. Yeah. And again, revenue growth is actually outpacing that volume growth, sitting steady around 18% year over year. The report basically says the model is on the cusp of profitability.
Right. But for years, all we heard about was subsidies, subsidies, subsidies. Unsustainable. How did they actually manage to tighten things up operationally?
Well, it seems to boil down to a couple of key things. First, just getting smarter with logistics, reducing the cost to serve, especially in those really dense city centers, optimizing routes, batching orders, that kind of thing.
Okay, the operational nuts and bolts.
Exactly. But second, and maybe more strategic, is this shift in how consumers see the service. They're pushing hard on affordability, trying to make food delivery feel less like a treat, less of a luxury.
And more like something you just do every day, a routine.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing that with, you know, different product mixes, different menu options designed for smaller order values, just making it a daily convenience.
That operational focus makes sense. But I have to say, the move into offline dining feels like a bigger leap.
Yeah.
It's not just about optimizing the delivery part anymore, is it?
No, it's definitely moving beyond delivery. They're trying to grab a piece of the total food services pie, the whole GMV.
How? By getting into the restaurant itself?
Kind of. It's a bit of a Trojan horse strategy, you could say. They're pushing into the physical world by offering digital vouchers and discounts for dining in restaurants. So they're not just selling logistics anymore. They're trying to own the whole consumer journey, right? From discovering a restaurant to paying the bill. They sort of cut off competitors before you even think about delivery.
So the app becomes your go-to for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Finding the place, booking the ride, maybe paying and getting a discount.
That's the idea. And for the platforms, the benefits are pretty clear. It makes users stickier, right? Less likely to churn. It expands their share of your wallet. And really importantly, it gives them a window into your offline spending habits. That's gold, data-wise.
But hold on. Offering like 10 to 30% off your restaurant bill? That sounds like subsidies again. Are they just trading delivery subsidies for dine-in subsidies?
Yeah.
Where's the profit in that?
That's the clever part, or at least that's the pitch. For the merchant, for the restaurant, it's actually a pretty good deal compared to delivery.
How so?
Well, those delivery commissions can be really high, like 20, maybe 25%. I talked to a restaurant owner just last week, and she said that just kills her margins.
Right.
So this dine-in voucher, it's like a cheap marketing channel for the restaurant. It gets people through the door buying high-margin food and drinks in their own place. Way cheaper than paying a 25% logistics fee.
Okay, so the restaurant saves money compared to delivery.
Yeah.
And the platform.
The platform makes money on the discovery, maybe on the payment processing, and crucially, on advertising. That's become a huge revenue stream.
Right. Advertising. That's popping up everywhere as a successful add-on.
Oh, absolutely. It's growing really fast, high double digits. These platforms are becoming major ad channels, especially for smaller, long-tail vendors who are getting pretty savvy with the ad tools,
And they pay because it works.
presumably. The platforms offer access to people who are right there, actively looking to buy food, high intent, better conversions.
Okay, so that streamlining in food, cutting back subsidies, optimizing costs, adding ads, it really shows how these platforms are maturing. Are we seeing that same kind of discipline in transport, or is that a bit more complex?
Transport's interesting. It's still growing steadily. They're projecting around $11.5 billion in GMV for 2025, growing about 16% year on year. So still strong growth.
Okay.
But the main theme here is definitely stability and really pushing for profitability. It's like, okay, keep the growth engine running, but this time the car actually has to pay for its own gas, you know?
Right. So how are they doing that? What are the different ways transport platforms are trying to boost profits?
They're getting quite sophisticated. There's a tiered approach to service different options for the mass market versus, say, high-value corporate clients.
Makes sense.
We're seeing subscription bundles pop up designed specifically to get people using the service more often. In-app advertising is becoming a factor there too, another revenue stream. And maybe most importantly, they're just being much tighter with consumer discounts and incentives. That directly improves the quality of the revenue they're bringing in.
And of course, you can't talk about transport in CCON without talking about EVs, electric vehicles.
Yeah, that shift is definitely accelerating. And it's being pushed by both sides, public and private sectors working together.
How so?
You've got governments offering pretty strong incentives. Vietnam, for instance, has subsidies for converting two-wheelers to electric. Indonesia's pushing local EV production.
Right.
But maybe the biggest driver is the transport platforms themselves. They represent this massive, guaranteed block of demand for EVs. They're arguably pushing the EV transition faster than almost any other sector there.
Okay, so steady growth, discipline, EVs.
Yeah.
That all feels like building a solid foundation. But then there's the wild card, is there? Autonomous vehicles, AVs.
Yeah. That feels like the really big strategic question mark on the horizon, both a huge opportunity and potentially a huge threat.
Definitely.
It's the inflection point everyone's watching, and it's not just talk. There are active AV pilots happening now in six countries in the region. That shows serious intent.
And the economics are the really interesting part here, right?
That's what the report highlights, the potential for robotaxis to actually become cheaper to operate than human-driven cars within like 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. That sounds incredibly fast, especially given where the tech is now. What makes that kind of timeline even seem possible?
Well, it hinges on a couple of big ifs. One is getting the manufacturing costs down, especially with vehicles coming out of China. The other is really nailing level four autonomy.
Okay, remind us, what does level four unlock operationally that, say, level three doesn't?
L4 is the big jump because it means the car can handle pretty much all driving situations within certain defined areas or conditions without needing a human driver to take over for safety.
Right. Fully autonomous in its own.
Exactly. And strategically, that allows for things like remote operators overseeing a whole fleet of vehicles, one person managing multiple AVs. That drastically changes the unit economics. Suddenly, the robotaxi could be cheaper than paying a human driver for every single vehicle.
But I mean, AVs are hardly a sure thing. The report itself says the pilots are still mostly in fenced low-speed zones. Doesn't that make the 3 to 5 year profit window seem, well, a bit optimistic? Maybe just marketing.
That's definitely the challenge. And it's why the strategy here has to be about partnerships.
Well,
The AV tech companies, the ones with the core systems and the funding, they can't just parachute in and succeed.
they need local help.
Desperately. They need to team up with the existing mobility platforms, the Grabs and Gojeks of the world. Those platforms bring the local knowledge, the huge customer base, and critically, the relationships and skills needed to navigate the regulations.
And why are the regulations such a crucial piece, maybe the crucial piece in specifically?
Because governments, there are, understandably, extremely cautious. Transport platforms aren't just tech companies, they're massive employers.
Right, millions of drivers and riders depend on them.
Exactly. So unlike maybe some other markets, regulators in Southeast Asia are trying to balance the potential economic upside of AVs with, you know, social stability. Job displacement isn't just a talking point, it's a massive immediate worry for potentially millions of people.
That caution from regulators is probably the biggest hurdle then.
It's certainly one of the key strategic factors that will dictate how fast or even if AVs truly take off at scale.
That tension, between the tech potential and the policy reality kind of brings us to the wider context for the whole ASEAN 10 region, especially around using AI for efficiency.
Yeah, absolutely. Because underlying a lot of this monetization discipline we're seeing in food and transport is AI. It's the tool enabling it.
Absolutely.
Platforms are using AI pretty broadly, front office, middle office, back office, to get more efficient. The report mentions Grab's AI driver companion as a good example.
What does that do?
Apparently, it helped boost daily earnings for over 250,000 drivers by something like 10 to 20%, better routing, matching, that kind of thing.
Wow, that's a significant gain.
It's huge. And that kind of efficiency directly impacts driver loyalty and ultimately the platform's bottom line.
But using AI in Xi'an isn't quite the same calculation as in, say, the U.S. or Europe, is it? There's a sort of paradox strategists need to grasp.
They really do. The big difference, the constraint, is labor cost. The report points out that weighted average wages in Southeast Asia are incredibly low compared to the West, like maybe only 5% of U.S. wages.
Okay, and that changes everything for automation.
It fundamentally alters the ROI. If your human labor is extremely cheap, you can't justify investing millions in AI just to cut a few headcount costs. The math doesn't work.
So it's not about replacing people cheaply.
Not primarily. It has to be about augmentation, about creating significant new value. The AI needs to solve a really complex, high-value problem, something worth, you know, maybe 100 times the cost of the labor it might displace.
Like what kind of problems?
Think large-scale, sophisticated fraud detection, or predicting complex supply chain issues, or, like the Grab example, measurably improving driver productivity by 10, 20% through smarter systems. It has to help the human workers do more or better, unlock new revenue, or prevent huge losses, not just replace the person doing scheduling.
So it's AI for effectiveness, not just efficiency. That's a crucial distinction for anyone trying to scale digital stuff across that huge ASEAN 10 market.
Absolutely. It really underlines why getting that scale and that monetization discipline right is so important for anyone playing in this region. The market's massive, yes, but the operating rules are just...
Yeah. Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. The key strategic shifts we've hit on. First, food delivery seems to have cracked the code, or is close to cracking the code, on profitability. They've pivoted to making it a routine thing for consumers.
Uh-huh. Focusing on affordability.
And they've made that clever move into dine-in, basically trying to own the entire food services journey, not just the delivery part.
Yeah, becoming dominant across the whole ecosystem. Meanwhile, transport is on a path of steady, disciplined growth. They're using smarter pricing, subscriptions, ads.
Getting the fundamentals right.
While also positioning themselves for that massive but very uncertain disruption coming from autonomous vehicles, which is heavily dependent on policy.
Right. And that leaves us with the big tension point, the real cliffhanger for strategists watching this space over the next few years.
The AV economics versus the social impact.
Exactly. The sources suggest robotaxis could be cheaper than human drivers in just 3 to 5 years. Huge potential economic win. But the regulators know how vital these platforms are for jobs, for social stability.
Mm-hmm.
So the real wild card isn't the tech anymore. It's the choices governments will make. How do you balance that economic potential against the very real fear of mass job displacement?
That's the tightrope they have to walk. And for businesses, especially the AV tech providers and the platforms, they need to come to the table not just with tech, but with credible answers for that socioeconomic transition. That's the strategic challenge.